Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, we are continuing to record this podcast remotely for the safety of our guests and our team. So, on with the show. Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks well-known friends three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And this week, my teenage self is beside herself because I'm joined by two women who throughout the 80s and 90s paved the way for women in music doing their thing, their way, ripping up the rule book as they went and igniting the charts the world over. They're the 80s girl band who became the biggest selling girl band of all time, bigger than even the Supremes. I'm talking 40 million plus record sales, US number ones, and sellout tours that, until COVID reared its ugly head, continue to this day. Growing up in Bristol, they became best friends at the age of four and have pretty much been by each other's side ever since, over 50 years on, as they inch their way towards their 60th birthdays. Their friendships seen them through their school years, through adolescence, global fame, band breakups, motherhood, comebacks, and even more comebacks, all of which is beautifully captured in their forthcoming memoir, Really Saying Something, which I devoured. They were the punk-fused pop stars, snarly, can't be asked, half-pissed, and as cool as you like. They sang, they danced, and they did everything to the beat of their own drum, refusing to do as they were told, usually by men, and for almost four decades have pretty much remained on pop's front line. I cannot wait to spend the next hour in their company. So let's dial up Kerin Woodward and Sarah Darlin from Bananarama.
I spent all weekend reading your book. But oh my God, what a nostalgia fest. Miner's makeup.
I know. Well, you're probably a bit younger than us, but did you have the white nail varnish? Because that was so the rage.
Yes, and then when I couldn't afford it, I used to have to resort to Tippex.
Oh God, yes.
Or like Kerin, shoplifting.
Did you shoplift? All my friends shoplifted and I didn't have the chutzpah.
It's the only time I got caught was stealing the white nail varnish.
You have remembered so much in this book. And I first of all, I take my hat off to you because I can't remember like last week, let alone, you know, when you met at the age of four. But going back and writing this book, how's it been for you? Because it's the first time you've ever done it in this level of detail, isn't it?
Yes, but to be honest, considering it's 50-odd years, that's quite a small amount of detail, really. And it's what to leave in and what to take out. We were just going to do the Bananarama story. And then the childhood, we started with a bit of childhood writing. And then couldn't stop. And it was just all about like little things about us wading upstream in with our trousers rolled up when we were about 10.
And I mean, the day we went to the park, coming home from school, get on your bike, go to the park, hang out. I mean, that
was
every day.
Everything.
But for years, that's what we did after school.
Yeah.
You know.
That's all anyone did. You got in from school, changed, got your roller boots on or your bike, got your chopper, off you went.
Oh, we didn't have a chopper.
No,
it was too expensive.
I wanted a chopper.
I had a Molson Mini.
So did I.
I love the detail in which you write about how skint you were, despite, certainly in your early days of Bananarama, you're selling millions of records, but you're signing on. You're absolutely brassic. You're living in, you know, rehearsal studios that are free of charge, and you're showering. Where would you go for showers?
Swimming baths, which is still there.
It's really funny there because they had like little stalls where you open the door and there's a bath in there, and Karen's somebody ran
they
the bath for you, and you paid 50p and you had a bath. I mean, that's almost Victorian. It's like,
well, it was. It was like a bathhouse in the Oasis swimming baths. I don't know if they still do.
They have that there.
But that was just at the end of Denmark Street where we were living. So that was what the rest of the time was a boiled kettle and a bowl.
Splash the face.
I mean, like when you say you're living in Denmark Street, that's like, you know, prime location now. That's multi-million pound addresses.
I know. It
was literally squalid.
Yeah.
It really was. It was a horrible outside toilet that was filthy. And I imagine the Sex Pistols had used 10 years before or 5 years before us.
It was their rehearsal studio, wasn't it?
Still belonged to those two, and they still rehearsed there with their new band. So, we just lived in what used to be the office above it. And so it had an old table and just had nothing in there at all.
No.
Cold water, no hot water, rubbishy toilet outside
and
in
leaky,
the yard.
Leaks in the roof
between
the beams. So we had just sort of carrier bags.
Catching the leak.
Catching all the water.
And Karen and I just took the mattresses from the YWCA, where we were living before that, while we were at college, while I was at college. We just dragged the mattresses down there and flung them on the floor, and that was it. I think we were only there for 6 months.
But
we were
so happy there.
Yes.
I mean...
Were you?
Well, such an adventure. I sort of think...
Soho. I mean, you're in the heart of Soho.
And back then, that was where everything happened.
Yeah.
It was. I think, it was just a place of huge excitement for us, the fact that we could walk out and just be in the middle of everything.
I don't know what it's like now in Soho with clubs and things, but back then there were clubs everywhere. And even if it was like for one night somewhere, everybody knew where to go. And so we literally went to millions of clubs and could just walk home or stagger home. And then the two of you used to plug in the electric guitars and just like have a great time.
Yeah.
And there are no neighbours, so no one complaining. It was really such a fun time.
And we had one
time.
Fan heater.
Yeah.
Fanny, who came with me from home. And my son ended up taking to university.
Did you?
And she still goes.
No.
She still goes.
Where is she?
That's amazing.
In Cornwall now.
Is she?
Yeah. Still in working order. Good old Fanny.
I love it. So all that detail, you've not forgotten any of it. And that's remarkable when you consider how much you've been through together. I mean, like, for years you've been on and off planes, touring the world. Life has never really, you've not like you've ever had those kind of 10 years of sitting at home getting fat.
Well.
Or have you? Not 10 years.
It was easier remembering all the childhood and the fun stuff and the club stuff we used to do.
Yeah.
But the Bananarama stuff, because it's like our fourth decade, that tended to blur into one. It's like,
when did we do that?
And then it's like, you can't say, well, I went to America, then I toured Australia, and then then we did that the next year and the next year. So it's like that became, that's what you do because that's your job. So really, I found the most enjoyable stuff to write about was obviously relationships with various people we had. We knew George, Michael, or Keith Flint from the Prodigy, but it was the childhood and the teenage and the excitement of leaving home and being in this hostel and then moving into the Pistols thing.
It was quite emotional, wasn't it? There were moments where we got quite emotional.
I'm not surprised.
Because of growing up sort of in each other's houses with each other's Sort of families.
The first Vesta curry we made.
We didn't put a Vesta curry in, did we?
We thought we were really exotic.
Water and stuff.
Yeah, but where we grew, I mean, you grew up in Bristol, and I'm from down the road in Cheltenham. But like, I remember not having Chinese food until we were 16, and like
the Vesta curry,
a Vesta curry would have been. Was it in a can? If it was in a can, we might have had it.
It was in a box. It was in a packet. You pull the top off, put it in a bowl, and put boiling water on. And they also did chow mein as well.
Yeah. I'm not sure we
have
that.
Fancy. See, our kids don't know what we went through. Our taste buds were so simple. It was either a Finder's crispy pancake or a Vesta curry. That's as exotic as it got.
For our first few years in London, we had no cooking facilities at all, apart from a kettle. So
we used to boil eggs in the kettle.
Smash.
And baked beans. Heat the beans in the tin in the kettle.
No!
Yeah! And then open it.
We both weighed about 7 pounds and thought we were fat.
Oh, you did everything your way or the highway, and I loved that. In fact, I think when French and Saunders tried to spoof you, it was almost impossible to spoof because that's who you were. So that kind of falling out of taxis, couldn't give a shit, I'm not doing that.
It was a slight exaggeration, but... I mean, we know we saw Dawn quite recently, and I just sort of, at the time, I sort of said, where did you get it from? And they actually got it from an interview from someone who had travelled round with us while we were working. It's like, well, I'm not going out there. I'd have to come in here. You know, it's like, we're sat when we're on that whole thing.
I was like, oh, just one more thing. Yeah. One more thing.
That's what we said last time. But to be honest, not much has changed.
We just tell someone else to say one more thing.
We don't have to.
But, you know, it's like you wrote the handbook for other female bands that came after you. I remember, you know, Nick and Nat sort of going, you know, when somebody was pushing them into doing something they didn't want to do in All Saints, it's like, nah, fuck it, Bananarama wouldn't do it. And it was great. It's like you paved the way.
They're brilliant. They really are.
They got all the same sort of bad press, I suppose, in as much as like, because they wouldn't do... what men ask them to do. They're like, oh, they're a bit difficult. It's like, no, they're just a bit intelligent.
Hag of difficult is so irritating. It just means that people can't take advantage of you. That's what it really means. And they don't like it.
Because of course they don't like it.
Dare you have an opinion or want to be in control of your career to some extent. Why wouldn't you?
Especially when you girls were doing it, because it was like, and you, mere women, speaking up, how dare you?
To wear what you want and sort of look how you want, as opposed to, you know, some record exec's idea of what might sell a record. But that, you know, to
I'm sure
that they did just let us go on with it when it was working.
I think it's much worse now.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
I mean, we were a kind of organic band. We put ourselves together and tried writing our own material and ended up writing some great pop songs. I don't know, not just girl bands, but any young bands now, how they all... whether they go about it in the same way, to be honest.
You were famous for saying no. And I wanted to know, what are the things that you're most proud of saying absolutely no way to?
Well, I am proud of it. Back in the 80s, we were asked to advertise hair curlers for an American company. I think we just had our first top 10 there. And they showed us the storyboard, and it was three fluffy girls in short skirts and tiny tops, tonguing their hair
and giggling.
And I just thought, that's your executive idea. You know, that's your idea of what three young girls should be doing. And it was just, that is so far removed from who we are. And we're just like, keep your $1 million
or whatever.
Everybody knew they couldn't change our minds, because also I think we were so desperate to be taken seriously and credible, and thought if we start doing hair curlers, it's just going to look so cheap enough and nobody will ever, you know.
But again, that's the sort of thing that you shouldn't really have to think about.
Well, you don't know. You're allowed
the same level.
Product placement is everywhere now, so it really doesn't, you know, everybody does it. That changed sort of when the Spice Girls happened. They, you know, it was okay to do then. But for us back 10 years before, it was just the worst thing to be done. Having said that, we did do two commercials in Japan, but they were from
But back then nobody saw them outside of Japan because the internet didn't exist.
Right, a piece of Honda. Yeah. So that was
But it was
that was cool.
But that was the thing, wasn't it? You would go and do, I've done an ad in Japan. Would you like to come to my second home that paid for it? There was a lot of that. So true.
As independence girls, you know, you have to think about the financial side of things as well, obviously. It's not like, you know, we were being looked after by anyone. It was all sort of self-made and, you know, we kind of were very independent in that route. So you have to think about money occasionally.
Yeah, you do. And you also managed to find a rare and an unusual thing at the peak of your success, a female manager in this industry, Hilary Shaw.
Yes. We had a couple of managers prior to Hilary, but she worked in an office that we started. Who was it? Clive Banks.
Yeah, she worked for Clive.
Clive Banks, who ran this company called Multimedia, and he paid for our first demo. So we knew Hilary from there, and after about a year, I think, she started looking after us, first as a PA. And it was kind of like a mother figure, really, because it was like a woman that would understand, you know, your problems, this, that and the other. And, and then after a while she became our manager.
We were never particularly good at being told what to do by anyone. And we had a few managers who, they'd come up with ideas and said, I don't like that idea. You know, we were very much self-driven. And Hills helped us sort of facilitate, as a group of girls, We managed to sort of pursue our own sort of ideas together.
Here's a couple of things that I know you said no to. One is the opportunity to work with Malcolm McLaren at a time when you probably really would have benefited from an association with him. But he had an idea that you would record a song that he was going to write for you called Don't Touch Me Down There, Daddy.
Yes. Like, what the hell is that? Really?
It's just gross.
It really is.
We went to meet him and he was quite domineering. I think he was trying on purpose in some ways to make us feel a bit awkward or to sort of make us feel stupid.
I think he went away and said that we looked like boys or something. Yeah. It was like really weird.
And he shouted at me like I was in the classroom. I remember sort of thinking, God, what am I doing here? And looking out the window and he said, Oi, you with the dark hair or whatever. It's like, how rude.
Very rude.
Yeah.
I don't think it was a serious. We met Bernie Rhodes from The Clash, who was also said, "Do you want to go? Can you go underground for a year and learn your trade?" And it's like, underground for a year at 19? No, we're ready to go now.
Must have been quite hard though to be assertive at a time when people were just not used to being spoken back at or challenged by female artists.
But that just came very naturally to us.
I think it was sort of post-punk, so you know, that there was a sort of attitude in the air.
And when you're young, it's like you don't care, because I didn't grow up thinking I'd be in a band. The fact that we were in a band was kind of by accident, because Karen and I lived in that rehearsal room, we met those sorts of people and then made a demo and Terry Hall bought it. It was all kind of accidental. But once we started it, it became very, very serious for us. But it was always, we didn't care if it ended the next day. It wasn't that kind of career planning. Let's see, project 5 years ahead and see where we'll be. And I don't think we do that now either.
No! But that is kind of the beauty of you. That was the magnetism, was like, to grow up for me, seeing women that I could walk to the shops every Wednesday fortnight to, so every other Wednesday I would go and get my smash hits. I just wanted to see what you had to say. Who are you going to piss off this week? Who are you saying no to? Where had you fallen over drunk in Soho this time? And you were unlike anything else that was around me. And it was, it was amazing. And I styled rags in my hair, loads of hairspray. I mean, to try and get my hair as big as yours was almost, almost combed a bald patch into the back of it.
Yeah, but I think it's so vital. Like you say, if we were kind of an inspiration to you, it's so vital for young girls to have someone to look up to, someone to say, oh, I can do that. I mean, for me, it was Debbie Harry. And it wasn't that I kind of related to her, because she was from New York and she was, as everyone pointed out, she was in her 30s. It's like as if that was well, it was old to me at 14. But, I mean, how dare they just say, oh, she's made it now. But she's quite old. She's in her 30s. And that really stands out to me. They kept putting that out there. And it's like, but she was amazing because she just looked tough and yet feminine and glamorous and great music. She embodied everything, you know, that I wanted to be. And it was very rarely you saw that in the 70s growing up with on TV. It was all very smooth men from America or rock bands.
Yeah.
But also she stood up front and they stood behind her. She wasn't supporting cast. She was the star of the show.
Yeah.
Star.
Yeah, and that in itself was just like, that was a breath of fresh air. Even with bands like Fleetwood Mac, you know, there was always that kind of male-female balance, you know, that it was a partnership between the four or five of them. Yeah. Whereas with Blondie was Debbie Harry.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to sort of be able to look attractive, she was incredibly stunning. And, you know, wear a mini skirt or wear a mini dress, and yet somehow not look like you're doing it to please men or you're doing it because you have to, just doing it because you look bloody hard like it. You know, it's, I think her attitude was amazing.
Totally. But then so was yours. You know, I remember buying a donkey jacket and some DMs because you had them. A donkey jacket. And I remember my dad, I was coming home and my dad went, bloody hell. I mean, it's what they empty the sodding bins in. And I was like, oh, so comfortable. And the DMs were so comfortable. I was like, I'm really on board with this lot. They're really comfy.
We find it strange that we became successful wearing that get-up. I mean, really, that's not, you know.
I mean, I've actually not feminine, met people who, like, I met males who said, oh, God, I really loved you lot. I really fancied you. I had your picture on my wall. And I was thinking, I just look like a boy. I had dungarees or, you know, I said in the book, I'm quite proud that we became successful pop stars, sort of wearing bloke's clothes in some ways and not conforming to some sort of stereotype. I think it's a really healthy way, you know, to be a role model for dressing like that.
And also, because
underwear, essentially, which is what you get.
Yeah, we had no money. So we went to Camden and Portobello Market and bought the old men's suit trousers and put braces on them.
Lawrence Corner was a favourite,
Lawrence
wasn't
Corner,
it?
And just, you know, and then we made our own clothes and there was, I can't sew for toffee, and it was diabolical. I made a shirt for Cheers then and it's made of heavyweight wool, and it makes me look like my hips look 6 feet wide. It's dreadful.
Yeah, we didn't think it through, did we?
No, I can't sew, I'm afraid.
Yeah, but you would turn up on like Top of the Pops or The Tube. I remember seeing you on The Tube. Mm-hmm. And you'd have these men's trousers on. You could clearly see that you just chucked some braces on and then just whacked a big belt around them. Yeah. So then I'd go up into my dad's wardrobe and, you know, what I would try to concoct was just a pile of shit by comparison.
I doubt it.
I'm sure it was exactly the same. Like a sort of busman uniform that you'd just adapted with, like, a pair of belt.
Yeah. Bus conductor chic.
Yeah, lumberjack shirt.
That was our first appearance on the Brit Awards, was wearing that.
Yeah, we were wearing grey sort of bus conductor trousers, moccasins, and lumberjack shirts and moccasins. Mm-hmm. I mean, what were we thinking?
It's a very odd look.
It was great.
Very odd look.
Yeah, but how comfy were you? You would have been so comfy.
Well, obviously, we did coordinate. So we all wore different shirts, but we coordinated our look. Yeah. It just wasn't necessarily a look that you'd expect on a huge award show.
Yeah, it looked like the before rather than the after.
Definitely downplayed it.
The other things that I noticed that you said no to, and these are just some of the few that I could find. Refusing to pose wrapped in towels, holding rubber rings, and most specifically when a photographer asked you to get on a fur rug and crawl like cats.
We're very fond of that man, actually. He was
hilarious.
It was hilarious. I think we did wear the towels and the rubber rings, and I just couldn't work out, what's that saying? What is that look? Why do I have the bath with a towel? That's that putting what you think women or girls need to do.
It's one of those things that you do once and think, I think once because you think, oh, it's the cover of the biggest pop magazine in the country. so we better play ball.
And then you see it everywhere.
Absolutely not. That is, you know, and then you never do it again.
And there was the shoot of you on inflatable bananas. And then never again did any shoot like that ever appear. And I'm figuring, that was your first one. First Bananarama shoot.
Well, we did have inflatable bananas styled by Boy George, wasn't it?
That was the foundry
shy boy
clothes.
Thing in the foundry yeah. clothes, but yeah. with so in quite cool clothes, but with inflatable bananas.
Yeah,
very odd. Really sure what was going on.
I don't know
there.
Why we didn't just say no and deflate them.
You gave us so much great. Content for Smash Hits, because you were the dream female pop stars and you really were redefining, you know, for all of those acts that came behind you. Have you, and I know that, like, I know, for example, that you're friends with some of the All Saints girls and that they've shared with you, I'm sure, over many a drink or two, what you meant to them. Have you had that same experience with maybe the likes of the Spice Girls and other female acts that have come since?
With Emma, I think Emma said that we were the first concert she went to, which was very sweet, and Mel Beazle was very flattering.
Yeah,
she said she'd seen us on TV and just thought that attitude, that whole thing, that, you know, I want to do that. And that, I think, it's so important for young girls, us or anyone else. We just need someone to look up to in all kinds of industries, not just music, to just think, yes, I can do that. Because if it's not there, you can't aspire to it. You can't. Feel like you're not part of it.
But when we did some promotion last year, because we had an album out last year, I was amazed at how many women in
editors of, like, big
or in quite high power jobs said, oh, I don't think I'd be doing this if I hadn't looked up to you, because it sort of made me think I can do that.
Probably more satisfying to hear from other women than getting an award or anything, to actually know that you know, you may have inspired
just as well,
somebody.
We never get any awards, do we?
You did get, you got a few Brits back in the day.
We only ever have one nomination.
No,
that's outrageous.
Well, you see, unfortunately, in the '80s, there wasn't a girl band; it was just a band. So it's
or a female.
It's obvious that a band is going to go to a boy. It's not going to go to women.
You highlighted one kind of brilliant point of illustration as to the gender imbalance in your heyday, and that was the Band Aid single. And apart from Jodie Watley, you were the only women in the lineup.
Yeah,
how wrong is that?
It's so wrong.
It seems a bit wrong, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how it happened. I mean,
and none of us had a lead line. It was all the males. I think that's a throwback from hundreds of years where it's patriarchal and it's just the way life is. And you just have to challenge that now. And but even in a small way, we've addressed that in the book. But I mean, it's just, you have to stand up and be counted, really, because otherwise it just doesn't move on.
Without people like you to show us that you don't have to say yes, you can say no, that you don't have to dress that way, you can dress your way, that you can have an attitude and an opinion and that be okay. Like, none of that stuff was permitted when I was growing up until you guys came along. And, you know, there's a brilliant story about when you were in America once and record executives put over a tannoy system in your hotel that they wanted you to come and join them in the jacuzzi. I mean, what the fuck is that about? And you just went, get lost, and went to the bar. Brilliant.
So many women in the jacuzzi with all these execs, and it was we just didn't look the part anyway. We had DMs on, and it was in our boy regalia, and it's just, it was just that Kevin and Perry moment doing that. It's those stereotypes, and we didn't consciously want to challenge them. It just felt like it came naturally. Why would we do that just because we're a girl? Why would we wear that just because you think that's what girls look like? Well, we'll do what we want to do. Not in a bolshy way, although sometimes we're a bit bolshy, but just in, these are my rights, let me have my rights. You do things you want to do, and I'll do it my way.
Group and say, you know, would you mind putting something a bit more skimpy on? Because we think it'll sell more
Gallagher.
Records.
Yeah.
Imagine going to Oasis. Yeah, but maybe you could just add a really tall
undid your shirt and put a medallion on.
Yeah. That'll sell something. You know, it is ludicrous the way it's always been that way.
But I remember the Brits performance that you gave because it was such, it was deemed, I mean, so controversial at the time. Do you remember? But yeah. You came on and you were backed by, I mean, like a throng yes. of throbbing male backing dancers yeah. in pants and DMs.
Stockings.
Although they were socks. Pants. They were long.
They wouldn't wear stockings because they just wouldn't. they were all like long socks mid.
And we had them side. On all fours and we had, but it was something that you would see in any video, yeah. any rap or rock video
yeah.
at the time would be probably still now. Gyrating it was a women.
Role. It was a role reversal, yeah. but it was tongue in cheek. Yeah, it wasn't like
totally.
Eat that and do it again. I mean, we didn't want to exploit them in that way. We just thought, what a fun idea for an award show.
And it was.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Your book is something of, you know, it encapsulates, I suppose, the greatest, the greatest moments and the most difficult moments of your life and times as friends and colleagues. And I thought about it in a kind of like a greatest hits package, like a liner notes thing. Back in the day when you would have sleeve notes and you would do your thank yous, if you had to compile a list of thank yous to the people that really were saying and doing and being and meaning something to you across the time that you've written about, who would they be and why?
My parents, for letting me believe I could do anything I wanted. I mean, they didn't have a sort of career like mine, but they enabled me to feel like not just because I'm a woman and I can have a career, I can have kids, I can do anything I want to do. And it wasn't that they even knew where I was going, they just let me go and do it. So it would definitely be my parents, that sort of moral code.
I think we had that from, you know, similar sort of parents, and yeah. neither of us grew up thinking that we couldn't do something because we were girls, which maybe looking back was quite unusual.
I think it really was. And I had a similar upbringing with yeah. parents. That, you know, I remember being shocked going into the workplace and experiencing sexism.
Yeah.
Like, well, what's that? What? Because I'm a woman.
Until we left home. That was when
yeah.
Yes. I mean, I went to the London College of Fashion to do a journalism course, and I had a day release at a music magazine, Sounds. I mean, I went there as a teenager and nobody spoke to me and they just made me make the tea. They didn't encourage me. They didn't help me to do anything. And it was all men. I don't remember a single woman there.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, the way it was. And it's that's so hard to, you know, burst out of and kind of go it alone, really.
Well, especially when you've made that big strident move, as you did, as I did, actually, to come and study journalism in London. You go, right, I'm going to leave the country, the countryside, which is basically anywhere outside of London, in your teenage mind, and I'm going to come to London. And then you encounter this terrible inequality, having been cocooned by wonderful parents that go, if you want to do it, do it. And never go, oh, yeah, but you're a woman. It was only when I went to a careers advice session at school and they told me not to want to be a writer, but to think about being a typist. That was my first experience of it.
Everybody's thing, was it? A typist. Well, and I always wanted to be a writer.
It was something secretarial or in a shop. It was the two things that I was offered, particularly, you know.
I mean, anything's fine. Whatever. It's whatever you want to do. It's just having the opportunity to do something else. But back in sort of 70s, 80s, it's like, what opportunities were there for women, really?
No. And, you know, you think the three of us have all predominantly raised children as single parents. Like, so back in the 80s, you would whisper about women that raised children on their own. Well, you know, she's on her own.
My mother was very disappointed that I was an unmarried mother. That was below her standards. And it was kind of, that's how she was brought up, to think, you know. So I think as much as I was always expected to be top of the class and, you know, achieve something, she was very disappointed that I wasn't married before. I didn't do it the right way. In fact, I never thought of getting married, but she was very disappointed. So I think she still had those attitudes.
And also, really? In the 70s, it was we didn't have the internet, so everything we learnt was from the TV, and it was so sexist and racist and homophobic. And that has to seep into your DNA, really, as a kid growing up.
And so it becomes a subconscious, unconscious bias.
Yeah, until eventually you start to challenge everything. And think, but that definitely was kind of, you know, that's in you when you grow up, because that's all you see.
Well, that is all you see.
Yeah.
Apart from in your own backyard, that's all you see.
So who were the ones that came and left a fantastic handprint on your life?
I would say Debbie Harry and Patti Smith, X-Ray Specs, all those female, Susie Sue, all those female punk stars. That's the first time I ever saw women that were sort of closer to my age, although not Debbie Harry because she was obviously in her 30s. But, God, you know, women can make music. They can go and do those things. And I just think they were very important at that age where I was sort of 13, 14, thinking,
And you didn't feel that there was some sort of Svengali, a bit like you look at the groups in the 60s, you felt like maybe the Motown stable or whatever.
Barry Gordy was there in the background.
More front people than actual artists that they weren't sort of taking control of their own careers so much. So I think that was a huge difference between the sort of punk acts.
Who were the people that took a chance and backed you? And I mean, would somebody like Terry Hall qualify?
I think most definitely Paul Cook, because we met him as teenagers, Karen and I, and just, I mean, he kind of showed us music, really, the music side of it, because he had the contact. So we made a demo and he arranged the studio time. So he was really important to us.
Or belief before we even had it in ourselves. I think he had some sort of belief in us.
And definitely Terry. Terry Hall.
I mean, Terry, when we first went in the studio, we just thought, oh, God, because we'd had a demo out, we thought, oh, he doesn't think that we're sort of professional session singers or anything. And he was so inclusive. And also, we were all pretty much shy together and we kind of mumbled at each other. And
well, Linville and Neville weren't shy.
No, only Terry.
Yeah.
But he was classic, very, very good company. Yeah. And we all played everything. It was all very do-it-yourself, which sort of just was the way we were, whether it was clothes or music, you know, just get on with it and do it yourself.
That must have meant a lot, actually, because he'd already been successful, had Paul, and then you're coming along and you've got kind of an idea but not really any idea about what you want to be and who you think you've got the potential to be. And these guys come along and go, yeah, we think you're cool, come on. Pick up that, try this, sing that, play that. And I mean, that must have been quite massive at the time in terms of permission to go.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely gave us a foot up, because then the next minute we were traveling to Europe and doing TV shows and we were on Top of the Pop. So, but I think in a roundabout way, we would have found a way through But Terry most definitely escalated that and definitely gave us the confidence to think, because he wasn't a big showman and confident, and, you know, he was kind of shy and introvert in some ways, but just hugely talented and really encouraged us. So that was, yeah, he was very important to us, I think.
And who else, when you think about the people that really were meaningful in helping you on your way?
When we got signed to London Records, our first label, it was very much a sort of novelty. But once it was working, they were hugely encouraging.
And they left us and they to left our own devices,
to get on with it. And we had the most hilarious pressman in Eugene Manzi.
Oh, God rest his soul, who left us earlier this year. Oh,
he took care of us like a dad. Yeah. He was so
amazing.
Lovely.
Yeah. And he used to come on trips with us even when he didn't have to. And we used to just go and sit in his office with him all day, every day, just to hang out and because we wanted to.
And Roger
Roger was hugely supportive
Tracy
as well.
Bennett.
And then we met Tracy Bennett. Oh, my God. There's another character that you don't see so much of in the business anymore.
Oh, God. He was hilarious. We had hilarious. Some really great people.
Yeah.
I wanted to time hop because your book looks back at so many key moments and milestones. So I just wanted to jump through some, maybe key stages or ages in your lives and see just instinctively what comes to mind when we hit this age and this time in your life. So imagine you're 18. Tell me about your life, your friends, your priorities, what's hanging in your wardrobe and what makes you happy and what makes you sad.
I would say secondhand clothes, most definitely, charity shops and Portobello Road Market, Camden Market, just getting all those clothes together for like 10p and then making an outfit and going to a club that, because you went to clubs every week and most weeknights as well.
Yeah.
So that was our life then. I was studying, but
for me it was getting clothes. Like a freedom.
Customising clothes.
Oh, it's great. You know, being independent, living on, you know, my own away from the family, just sort of taking off and discovering a whole new world as an 18-year-old. So just general excitement and substandard accommodation.
Yeah, / squalor. Yeah.
But it was so exciting.
We would go out all night clubbing and then this poor little old man would have to answer the door because it was important. They closed the doors at 10 o'clock. So it was almost like being in a convent again. It's just like,
it really was.
Yes.
After your BBC fry-up.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what were your priorities then? Just good times?
Fun. I think a lot of fun.
Well, obviously I was studying, but then suddenly the idea of the group, but it was meeting really creative people that, you know, we had never met before.
It was sort of opening our eyes. It was sort of opening our eyes to things and new experience. It was all new experiences.
From
and we
our
wanted
clubbing,
as many as we could get.
Our clubbing, we first came across Boy George, Jeremy Healy, Mark Moore from S Express. I mean, all those people were not who they were then, and neither were we. And then suddenly lots of people, even from the Blitz, Spandau Ballet. I mean, loads of people went on to be other things.
It was a very creative cultural sort of time for youth, I think, in those days. And I don't know if that sort of thing really exists now because everything seems to be online.
Clubbing was very much dressing up and really everybody had a character and just it was the excitement of dressing up, which I guess people still dress up, but it was like really mental dressing up, wasn't it?
Experimentational in that it wasn't just, put on a bit of lippy. It was, what are you going to do for your look tonight? And there's some very strange ones of me in the book.
You haven't got the film.
I love them though. But I remember we had Martin and Shirley Kemp on and they were talking about exactly this time. And, you know, you're right. It would be like a Tuesday night and you would spend hours getting dressed up and you wouldn't just do a little bit. It was a look. It was a theme.
Yeah.
You know, it was. And then you would go out and there was this kind of petri dish of amazingly creative people who all went on to become significant in terms of the cultural landscape of that time. And sometimes those people are just drawn together, aren't they? The most kind of magnetic.
I think, but also because it was so, it wasn't designer clothes and expensive things. It was really just customizing, you know, cheap things from, as I say, markets and high street or whatever, and creating these incredible looks.
And then later in the 80s, we gravitated. We had a very sort of artistic set around us, didn't we? Mowgli and John and
Lee Bowery.
And we sort of hung out in a different kind of environment, but with equally exciting creative people. Yeah. And it's just, it's quite inspiring being with people like that, people who think a bit differently, and, you know, you can learn a lot.
Okay, let's fast forward to your 30s. Tell me again where you're living, who your friends are, your priorities, what's hanging in your wardrobe.
Where are we living? I think we're in Kentish Town.
Yeah, in my 30s.
We both had children.
I moved to Cornwall at some point in my 30s.
Yeah.
So we had the kids. We both had kids at that point.
Yeah, you moved to Cornwall and I went clubbing.
That must have been quite a wrench for you two because you'd been so close for so long. And then Karen moves to the other end of the country.
Kind of many issues, you know, a lot that's in the book. I think for me, I definitely needed some sort of change because it, and that was the change I made that I chose. And I'm still there. So it was the right one for me. Having said that, we do spend still a lot of time, obviously, together.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, we go through our ups and downs the same as everyone else, but essentially we've always been best mates. And
I'm fidgeting now, sorry.
Am I making you uncomfortable?
Yeah. Sarah, were you sad when she moved? Because it's a big thing to lose a mate to 100 miles away in another life.
More or less 300 miles
away. Well, yeah, hundreds of miles, yeah.
Hard to answer that in a condensed couple of sentences because it's so much more involved than just someone moving X number of miles away. There were reasons for it. And we were, I think, mentally in different places at that point. So you'll have to read the book and see
why. Talking really strangely, talking about it recently, if we were talking about the 90s or whatever, or the time I moved to Cornwall. And strangely, when we were looking back, we had so many amazing, fun times together at a point where we sort of felt like we'd gone our separate ways, but we didn't. We did loads of holidays. We did,
but also, even being close friends, there was so much that we hadn't actually spoken about. I didn't realise Karen's depression. I didn't know it was that serious. I mean, that only came out really with the book, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's an extraordinary thing to keep from your closest friend.
Well, I might add
selfish
thing of just, my mother had suffered from depression her whole life and it was always brushed under the carpet. And I think we did that with quite a lot of things. You know, we're from a generation that something's wrong, well, just get on with it. You know,
I'm very much that sort of, just get on with it. I might think, a bit sad, right, no, I'll get on with it. Whereas Karen's is obviously a bit more than that.
A bit more of a blip here and there.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if you sort of recognise, you know, signs and things, you can deal with it, you know.
It's hard though, isn't it? Because if you were always used to having a good state of mental health, when that isn't the case, it's shocking because you start to think, well, what have I done wrong? You don't understand that sometimes you've done nothing.
Sometimes you only realise when it's actually quite bad, you know, because you just let things go on and on and on. And, you know, I think a lot of people didn't. They talk a lot more about mental illness, and I just felt like a bit of it needed to go in the book because it's been a feature on and off in my life, and it's something that I grew up with my mum, so I kind of feel like I can talk about it.
Is it something that you talk about with Tom, your son, because you want him to be mindful of the fact that this is something that's, I don't know, not that it's hereditary because there's nothing to prove that that's the case, but...
Like my mother in any way, shape or form.
Oh, but you are.
No, I'm not. No, I think we've been very open with our kids, probably in a way, you know, we've spoken to our kids and had our kids as I mean, we're obviously parents, but we're friends as well in a way that we didn't have with our own parents.
Hang on, I did.
Well, not in the same openness, I don't think.
You speak for yourself.
All right. And I think that, you know, by discussing, and you can learn from mistakes in your past. And I think there's an honesty. I have an honesty with my son, and he's very honest with me, which maybe I didn't have when I was younger with anyone. You kind of come, don't admit your weaknesses.
But I don't think that changes. I think people still do.
They do.
It's just that encouragement to draw things out. But I don't think.
No one used to talk about issues like
that. Nobody did.
What's difficult is for like young boys, because they're always taught to be a certain way and not cry and not show emotion. I think you really have to change how they can
be emotional.
Totally. I mean, I'm raising him. My son's 12, and we talk about his feelings all the time. How do you feel about that? And how did that make you feel? Yeah. I really, really want to have an emotional connection with himself.
Yeah,
because, you know, you're right. Growing up, nobody talked. No. If somebody wasn't well, they'd say, oh, you know, they just point a finger to their head like they were crazy.
Yeah.
You know, if someone had a mental illness, there was it was kind of a one sort of finger gesture fits all, bit nuts.
Yeah, they always chuck away somewhere in some, derogatory
name.
That's
very much how I treated my mother's depression. It's like, God's sake, what's wrong with you? You know, and
you being
very
it.
Impatient, I didn't understand it. But I mean, people talk about it a lot more now, and other stuff. You know, it's like sort of 1 minute people, no one talks about, I don't know, middle age, menopause, and just suddenly it's like, all right, enough already.
Yeah,
you've heard enough about the bloody menopause.
but isn't it mad that we grew up not knowing about it?
Yeah.
It's a bit like, you know, nobody tells you about placenta when you give birth until you're pregnant.
Yeah. It's quite shocking. And but people always say if it was a man going through that, you'd know
absolutely everything.
They'd be allowed to.
They'd retire at 45 just in case.
Absolutely.
So let's fast forward to your mid-40s. You're 45. How's life changed? Are you still living in the same places? Are your priorities shifted? Has your lifestyle changed?
My actual favourite decade was 35 to 45, I think. I loved that.
Ibiza.
I loved that time. We were partying. We looked great.
Yeah.
We were doing loads of shows again and going to most amazing places. And life was good. Life was good. I loved my 40s.
Yeah.
We had a lot of great times, both working and holidays, and I think we allowed ourselves a bit more time to go and have fun together and just hang out, as opposed to just working through those sort of 10 years, sort of 35 to 45. And I absolutely loved it.
What have been the big takeaways for you from the pandemic in terms of making you rethink how you look at the world and what you want from life?
Well, just like we said, you can't imagine that your whole livelihood would be taken away from you. And people are in much worse positions than
but
us.
It's not being able to actually see friends and family for me was everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in Cornwall. I mean, only communicating by a screen. I mean, it was.
Other than us two, we've seen each other constantly.
Yeah, we've been in bubble because that's what
the Bananarama bubble.
Oh, that's so nice. At least you've got each other.
Yes. For the first 3 months, to be fair.
But I haven't seen my mum for ages, and I just hate it. I hate it.
And when you finish the book and you finish in the here and the now, are you happy with where you are in the here and the now as you kind of, I mean, edge towards the end of your 50s? Is life good?
Yes.
In some ways, I feel happier than I've ever been. I think
that with age comes that, like, I didn't care right when I was very young. And then you're very aware of, what does this make me look like? Was this just... And now you're at the age where you just think, no.
It doesn't really matter.
It doesn't matter.
Does it?
You're just happy with, you know, your health, and different things mean different things to you now, don't they? What's the importance of them?
I just want to say thanks. Thanks for being there. Thanks for being in my eye line and for leading by example, because I wouldn't have sat in the editor's chair at Smash Hits had I not had people like you guiding me that way.
Okay.
And then leaving the door open for other women to come and sit in that chair. And that's...
You can actually sit and share a glass of white wine.
Yes.
Oh, girls, I really do look forward to seeing you in real life. Get back on the road as soon as you can, as soon as COVID permits. And thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having
us.
That's it for this week's White Wine Question Time. Pinch me.
it's over. But we'll be back next week. As always, the show is produced by me, Kate Thornton, with Richard Hatherall for Yahoo UK, and Callum Goddard-Mocklow is on editing duties. Music is provided by Andy Bell. His back catalogue with Oasis, Ride, and his solo projects are available on iTunes and Spotify. I'll be back next week. I can't believe that just happened. Happy days. Pinch me. And don't forget, always drink responsibly.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.